Now I would like to take a moment and introduce our speaker. Marlena and I actually met last year and spoke, and we've had the pleasure of speaking several times since. I've really come to appreciate her, also her experience, and the work that she has done since her experience. Oftentimes when you hear a near-death experience, you hear a very expansive experience where there's a lot of elements, a lot of things have happened to the individual in the experience. It's captivating. Not all experiences are like that, but every experience is powerful and transformative in nature. Marlena's experience, if you were to put it on balance, would not be an expansive experience at the beginning, but the impact it had on her life, it was transformative. That's the one key element that separates out a near-death experience from all other experience, is the transformative effect it has on the individual. Marlena's experience is similar to mine in the sense that my experience on balance really wouldn't be considered expansive at the time I had my experience. But at different points since I had my experience, other pieces, if you will, to the puzzle fell into place. It was almost like it was meant to be at the time I needed it and the time I was ready for it. And that was the thing that intrigued me about speaking with Marlena, was the fact that hers was similar to mine in that respect. I wanted her to have the opportunity to share her experience with you and to also share how the experience not only helped her at the time she had her experience, but also how it aided her in a life of service that she has had in several different areas, and how this experience helped her assist children and adults transition from life to death, and to do it without fear. I really want to thank her for giving her time and being able to share with you this evening. Marlena Tumlin.
I'd like to start out by saying thanks to Bill for calling me and saying, "Are you going to be in Utah anytime soon?" I have a condo in Bountiful, so I'm kind of back and forth, having had lived here before and have two children and three grandchildren here in Utah. So I'm one of those foot in two different places. Also want to thank Jeff Olson, who has become a wonderful friend and who is speaking this evening in the North Carolina IANS meeting. He's down there for a conference with physicians to help educate them. Also in the audience tonight is my daughter, my dear friend Margaret, who's also urged me to talk story. You might say that I'm a person who's very comfortable with death and with dying and with those people that are dying. In fact, sometimes my children always say, "Oh, you know, it's a mom's kind of movie. Somebody dies in the end." So, what can I say? It was not always that way. It started out, I was very frightened of dying because before I was 10 years old, I'd lost my twin sisters, my father, the month before my 6th birthday, my grandfather and my stepfather, all before I was 10 years old. So I was kind of thrown into this whole business of dying. And to a small child, death often means abandonment. And so it felt as though I was abandoned with all of these people dying. And it kind of remained that. I feel like for a good portion of that early life, I was very fearful of a lot of things. Fearful of being alone, fearful of what death would do in terms of taking the people that I loved away from me. Until the night in Colorado, I was traveling from California to Colorado to have my second child because I had a 2-year-old and I needed somebody to be with him. And my husband was busy traveling back and forth from West Coast to the East Coast. And so I came to get a nice babysitter and I came to have my second child. And I was prepared. I had been to the doctor that day and they said, hey, you're not going to go for a while. So I called my husband and I said, you know what? We can set up the time. It looks like it's going to be about 2 more weeks. Well, instead of 2 more weeks, it was about a couple of hours that I went into labor early. And this was in the evening. And so my mother drove me to the community hospital in Boulder, Colorado, where I'd had my first child as a student there. All of a sudden, it's May. It's cold in Colorado in Boulder in May. And there I am. My mother's going back, waving goodbye. My husband's in California. And the nurse comes in and says to me, oh, it doesn't look like you're going to have this baby until morning, so I don't think I'm going to call the doctor. Well, it was fine for her to say that, but as she put me in this room that was completely darkened, and here I am, alone, darkened room, and there I sit. And, of course, all of these fears began to multiply as my pain began to get worse. I remember thinking, oh, my gosh, is anybody going to be here ever in this darkened room? And all of a sudden, my legs began to go into a tremor, and I could not control them. They started to shake, and my body was really racked with pain. Little did I know, this child was 3 pounds heavier than my first child. So those of you women that have had children know that that's a little different kind of labor. And so as I'm there, lying in this dark room, no one there at all of a sudden, in the midst of this intense pain, I'm out of my body. And for a moment, I said, did I just die? Is this what it's like? Because there was no more pain. I felt completely pain-free. That did not mean I was free of my fears. In fact, I soon realized that there was a presence. That's the only word I can explain. It was a presence that surrounded me. And I could communicate with that presence through my mind. And I could ask a question, and there would be an answer. And so I started to bargain. I said, look, I just want my doctor. I just want a nurse. I want a husband. I want my mother. And then I was down to, I'll take a hand. Can you just give me a hand? And at that point, I remember thinking, then what about just a finger? Could you give me a finger? Because I know if I can have that finger, I'll be okay. And I heard this incredible voice coming through that said, you think you are alone, but you're never alone. And in that moment, instantaneously, I felt an incredible oneness with everything. I don't know how to describe it except to say that there was no separation from anything, and that I felt tremendously grateful for that oneness. And in that space of oneness, I felt this incredible love surround me and permeate through everything. And the wonderful thing, not just the pain was gone, but the fear that I was feeling completely dissipated. I wanted to stay there. I thought, wow, if this is death, I'd just as soon be here because it's such a beautiful place to be. When Bill and I spoke, he said, what would you call that presence? would you say it was God? And actually, I said, yeah, I guess so. But as I began to think about it, it was the God of my understanding, which was very limited, but it was a whole different kind of presence than I had known growing up in my Presbyterian church. And I think the greatest difference was the fact that I could, that this presence or this God of my understanding could communicate with me on a personal level, that there was no need for an intercessor. There was no need for a minister, a priest. It's the moment I thought something, there was the answer inside of my head. As I remember thinking that I would just want to stay in that place where there was really nothing but love and nothing but this presence surrounding me. And then all of a sudden, I was back into that body, and I was back into the pain and back into the darkness. But the fear was not with me. The fear was gone. And of course, as you know, if you're in labor, the end result of that is a baby. And so by the next morning, doctor did arrive, and I had a very large baby girl. Now, I can't say that I saw this immense light when I felt that oneness. I was still in the darkness. But I think the light that I felt was something inside of me. The enlightenment, if you will. The light that came from the center of me and radiated out. Not something that was far away from me. I remember going home with this new baby and thinking, who can I talk to about this incredible experience? In talking, there was really no one that wanted to hear this experience. And all I could say was, I think that experience changed me cellularly. I felt somehow my cells weren't quite the same. Now, no magic occurred. I ended up having another child. But what did happen was that experience created a segue, a pathway, if you will, in which I could walk this path. And the path was not directed by my fears, but it was directed by light or love. It was just different. And I had the sense that things were not just happening to me. That's how it felt inside of me. And so I began to be much more independent. Once I shed my fears of dying and my fears that I had of being alone, I was able to have the courage to leave that marriage, which was not a particularly good marriage to begin with. And I was able to be a single parent. I was able to love again. And it almost seemed like the experience did two things. It expanded my consciousness, but it also broke open my heart. And in the breaking open of my heart, instead of closing down with losses, it seems as though it just opened up. And I think there's a wonderful song, Hallelujah. He says, we have broken hearts so that it allows the light to shine through. And that's the experience that it was for me. Now, I didn't magically become this super spiritual person, but what did happen was, in a period of about 20 years, I went back to school. I got my bachelor's degree. I got my master's degree. And I began to really know that the path I came to walk was a path of service, and particularly for those disenfranchised people who were kind of on the edge that didn't fit. and I seem to be there as their advocate. So I've worked in special ed for 12 years. I was able to work in refugee resettlement. I brought 40 children in, found homes for them, and adopted a Cambodian son. And my life just kept opening, that every time there was a loss, it seems as though it broke open another shell. And so I found myself in a situation that really tested this whole theory for me. I was in a situation in which I basically lost everything. My husband, my then husband, left me for my best friend, who I thought was my closest confidant. That was worse than losing him, believe me. I lost all of my stepchildren. I lost my home 2 weeks before Christmas. I lost my job because I was working with him. And I had 3 children that I was, again, a single parent for. And here I am, having to move, wondering what in the world I was going to do. And again, Spirit spoke and said, redirected my life. I had remembered somebody saying, a hospice is looking for someone to set up a daycare center. I went to that particular hospice. Believe it or not, I was hired on the spot to set up a daycare center. Hey, I said, I'm a teacher. I know how to do that. I could do it in my sleep. So in 6 weeks, they had their daycare center set up for the children of their employees. And I started talking with the nurses, and I said, I know a lot about grief, especially childhood grief, because I spent a lot of my childhood in that grief response to all those losses. And so she urged me to write a program. She said, why don't you write it up? And so I wrote a program called CHILD, which was an acronym for Child's Help in Living and Dying. And the upshot of it was I was certified as a loss and grief counselor, went back to school, and that journey would take me to 5 different hospices. But the most incredible part of that journey was 5 years working with dying children. During that 5 years, I sat or held hands with at least 20 children as they passed from life into that space we call death. I was in West Palm Beach, Florida. We had the highest incidence in the late 80s of pediatric AIDS in the country. AIDS had shifted from a male, gay, men's disease to women of color, IV drug users. And so we had this high incident because we had a sugar plantation in our Palm Beach County and a lot of Haitian workers. And I was working as in a hospital trauma center. I was working at the county public health, and I was working at a pediatric AIDS hospice. So I got to follow these children from the beginning of their disease to the hospitalization to back to the hospice. And these children were the greatest teachers that I ever had. And coming out of that incredible loss, redirected to my life into something that I would never have imagined could happen. The stories of these children were incredible. They were not frightened of death, but they did ask me 2 questions. The first question they ask is, does it hurt to die? Because dying was sure painful. And I could tell them that no, to die does not hurt. This is the part that hurts. The other question they asked me constantly was, what's it like to die? That's really what started me in my interest in near-death experiences, because I could tell them about my small event, but I wanted to tell them the stories of those who had died and come back to share that. I had many, many children I worked with, but I had one particular child who I am going to share his story, if I may, just a bit of his story tonight. He was 4 years old, not quite five. He was actually a child of my heart. I adored this child, and I would work all day at the hospital, and I would stop on my way home to the hospice and sit with him, sit in the rocking chair, rock with him, and he would always say to me, "What did you do today, Marlena?" He wanted to hear what was going on. Or, "What are you going to do tonight?" So one day we had our conversation, and I said, "I'm going to go pick out a Christmas tree." And he said, "Could I go?" And I thought, one of the nurses said, "Well, you're on staff if you want to take him." Now, I have to tell you, in stage AIDS, if any of you have ever seen it, he looked like a concentration camp survivor. This little black child who was so thin, and he and I went hunting for a Christmas tree. Now, that was about as fast a Christmas tree as anybody has ever picked out. In fact, he didn't know it, but I had to go back and get another one because that one just didn't work. So every night he would say to me, "Marlena, have you put the lights up yet? Are they up?" And I promised him that I would take him to my home to see them. My daughter is here. She was there as a still in high school, I think, or maybe in college just. And we had put lights everywhere in my house, all the way to the townhouse. There were lights. The Christmas tree was glowing. When I picked him up from the hospice, he had his brand new cowboy boots and a beautiful little outfit. And he sat next to me. And as we drove, it had been raining. And everywhere I looked, I saw these red and green lights that reflected in the pools of water. And everywhere we seemed to look, we saw lights. He came to the house. He said, "I've never seen your upstairs. Could I see that?" We took him upstairs. "I'm hungry," he said. Now, he always wanted to eat. He couldn't keep anything down, but he always wanted to eat. I was having a Christmas Eve party. So I said, "I've got turkey, anything you want. I want a grilled cheese sandwich." My daughter fixed him a grilled cheese sandwich. He had about a bite out of it. And he looked at me and he said, "I'm so tired, Marlena." And so I took him back to the hospice. That was Christmas Eve. He lived until the last day of December. His father was from Barbados, the islands, and was raising two children, both who had HIV, one full-blown AIDS, given to them by their mother, who was an IV drug user. When the last moment in the hospital, when I was holding him, he said to me, and he started to cry, and he said, "I know that my daddy loves me, but I don't know about my mom." Here's a four-year-old. And I said, "Why do you think that is?" He said, "Because when she does her drugs, she doesn't look at anything else or see anything." And I said, "You're right, TJ. But I want you to look at me," because I was always very honest with him. I said, "In her heart, she loves you. I know that." And I probably held him that evening for maybe 4 or 5 hours. And very late that evening, his mom came in, who hardly ever saw him, and stayed with him the last few days in the hospital. We drove together to the hospice to take him there. And she told me her story. She said, "You know why I do drugs? I was raped when I was 14 by a neighbor. And she said, I was in so much pain when somebody offered me something to take away the pain, I took it. And that something was addictive. And she was crying because she said, I don't even have a stomachache and my son is dying. We took him to hospice. He lived a few more days. His mother never saw him again. I called his father when I knew it was very close. And I put him in his father's arms. And he sat with him while he took that last breath. He used to wear a little ponytail. And he used to get very mad when people thought he was a little girl. And his father cut the ponytail off and he said, this is for me. His mother never saw him again. Now, I'm going to share something with you if I don't start crying, because it's something I rarely share, but I think I can share it in this audience. Years later, probably 10 years later, I was in Washington, D.C., working at a hospice there, working only with adults. And I did the grief support groups. And one of my members said to me, would it be okay if I brought in a woman to share in our group who sees spirit? And I went, well, I don't know how hospice would do with this. This was a huge D.C. hospice. But if I meet her and I feel she's legitimate, then I will be glad to have her come to my home. And we can invite whomever we want, people from the group, or you can invite your friends. Well, I met this wonderful woman. She was a fine artist, and about at the age of 40, she was given the gift of being able to see spirit. She came to our home, and we had about 25 people in the house. Half of them I didn't know because they were friends of my friend Gloria from our group. And I'm hearing in my head again that communication, she's going to come to you last. Now, I don't know if any of you have ever been in the presence of someone who sees spirit, but she just stands in front of somebody and she starts kind of looking over their head and talking. I'm hearing she's coming to you last. Sure enough, every person, 24 people, and I'm thinking, right. And she stood in front of me and she said, I'm seeing someone, I think it's a little boy. He's about this tall and he's holding out a star and it looks like a Christmas ornament. Would it mean anything to you? Would it mean anything to me? I started to hyperventilate. Tears were coming down my face. And I thought, oh, so this is why she was coming to me last. And she said, he's holding this out. And then she said, oh, my goodness, there are all kinds of small children behind him. And they're all coming. And they're saying thank you for taking the scary out of dying for them. And of course, by this time, I could hardly speak. And she said, he says something else to you. He said, thank you for what you did for his mother. Here were the three of us in the car when she's telling me the story of how she was raped. He said, thank you so much for giving my mother that gift and knowing in my heart that she loved me. I wrote a book, my memoir. I never had a voice, and it became my voice, but it was more than my memoir. It was the memoir of all the children I worked with, all those little disenfranchised children who would never have a voice. I chose not to put that in my book because I thought nobody's going to believe this. I'm sharing it tonight because I have a suspicion that in your heart some of you will believe that that actually happened. I have never had any more communication with him, but I think he said it all when he said thank you for taking the scary out of dying for us. And that's primarily what has happened to my life. Is that someone far greater than myself has taken the scary out of dying for me. So that my life just keeps opening up. Basically, I'm back here in Utah because Spirit has spoken to me and said, I want you back in Utah. So I don't know what the next journey will be, but I'm open. And I know that whatever the law says, there is always the counterbalance to that. I know that absolutely for a fact. So my story, nothing glamorous or great or large, but for me, it's what has directed my life. I have been given this great gift of being able to sit with those that are dying, because that veil is really thin between this side and that side. I want to end my part by simply saying, in my book, it was perception. Memoirs are perceptions. My mother was so annoyed because she thought the book was about her that she actually ripped out pages. It was very painful. And again, I spoke to Spirit and somehow was able to resolve that with her. Ask her to send the book back. And I didn't know what to do with this damaged book, so I buried it. But I was awakened by Spirit in the middle of the night. And the voice said to me, this is how I want you to end the book. So it's the only absolute truth in the book. And what I heard was this. There is no one that has more access to God than you. And there is no one that God loves more. Thank you.
As I alluded to at the beginning, is that oftentimes in a near-death experience, it's going to either be everything at once or it's going to come in pieces, such as it's happened in Marlena's life. The question I have is specific to your hospice work. We've had a number of hospice workers over the years that have spoken, and kind of what they have shared on numerous occasions is that as people are making the transition from life to death, they're often in presence of what I will say is a guide, someone to facilitate that death. And I was just wondering if you could share if that is something you experienced in your hospice work. The reason I'm asking the question is that the reality of life and death is that veil is really very thin. And my analogy is it's kind of like being in a house where in life you share maybe one common room for your interaction and your connection. In death, you're still sharing the same house but in a different room.
Yes. As a matter of fact, what we would always do is we'd tell people, don't be dismayed or surprised or if some strange thing happens to you, because it's very likely that this will be. And often we saw people talking to people who were not there or saying, oh, mother's here, someone who's 92. But I did share this with Bill, and it's actually a very funny story. I worked at a hospice in Boca Raton, Florida. Primarily, our people who came to the hospice is a very large Jewish population. There were two of us doing the bereavement work, myself with the younger people, children who had children, families, and Paulette, my co-worker, who she and I always said to people, again, everyone we work with, don't be surprised. And so she came in one day. She was laughing so hard she could almost not stand up. She said, you're not going to believe what just happened. She said, this man came in the door, shut the door because he didn't want anyone to hear. He said, let me tell you something. I'm a secular Jew. I don't hear things. I don't see visions. I don't hear things in my head. And I'm sitting there in my mom's room, and I'm looking up against that white wall, and I'm seeing that woman, you know, the one that has the blue veil that's in all those hospitals. Paulette, who was Catholic, said, "Oh, you mean Mother Mary. That's the one," he says. Now, he says, "I don't hear things, but she's talking to me. And I'm hearing her." And she's saying, "Your mother is in lots of pain now, but she's soon going to be out of pain." And he said, "You know what? She just died the next day." And of course, according to Jewish beliefs, the funeral happens very quickly. No embalming. And he said, "And there she is again, standing there, talking to me. And I don't hear things. And she's telling me, 'I told you, your mother would be at peace soon.' And she is." So that was just one funny story. This man was so convinced that he was not hearing or seeing, and that somehow she should know that about him. And yet, a Jewish man sees a Jewish Mary, right? Because we always said, you know, obviously Jesus and Mary were both Jews. That was just one experience. Lots of other things that were some funny, some poignant.
Well, I'd just like to say, first of all, that you're a phenomenal speaker. Thank you. You mentioned the fear that you had as a little girl for a long time. And after your experience in childbirth, you came back. You felt like there was some molecular change or something that took away the fear. Can you expound just a little more on the effect that had?
Bill was also asking about that sense of oneness. It was hard to describe. There actually are no words. We lived in Hawaii at one point, and there are some beautiful Hawaiian words that describe. The word for oneness is ono, and it means connected to the aina, which is the earth. It means connected to the fear. It just felt inside of me as though there were no divisions at all. It wasn't right, wrong, good, bad, yes, no. It was all the same. Only way I could describe it was it felt like something had changed internally. I didn't know what it was. I was 23. I had no clue. And the only way I could describe it was to say it felt like cellularly I had changed. But since then, I've had more of those oneness experiences. And I came to believe that most of our problems stem from the fact that we see ourselves separate, that we want to say, this is good, this is bad, this is right, this is wrong, this is love. The fact is they're all intertwined. They're all the same. That you can't have grief without that great verse in the Bible that says, sorrow comes in the evening, but joy comes in the morning. Is just that. They can't be separated. And so I don't see things anymore in those dichotomies, even though we live, especially now in this world that is completely polarized, it seems. I try to keep that oneness, that same place in my heart. No words can explain it, really.
First of all, I'd like to thank you for being so glamorous, you know. When you said that you didn't have anything very glamorous, I got an immense chuckle out of that. But your story was beautiful. Glamour, we don't need.
Thank you.
My question would be, when you made the comment that things happen not to you but for you, what kind of process do you go through if you do? If you could describe the process that occurs when something really bad or crummy.
Yeah.
Could you describe that process?
Well, I think that whole business of saying that things are not happening to me. I used to feel that these horrible things were thrust upon me somehow, and that it was, oh, how do you get through this? How can you ever get through this? It was actually just this past Sunday that came to me while I was sitting, actually in a church service. I thought, wait, things were happening for me. By that I meant that things were happening for me so that my consciousness could expand even more. Now, in the midst of when those things were happening, for example, when I had to leave my home 2 weeks before Christmas, had no job, had all of that happening, I don't think I could see it right at that moment. But it's when we look backwards that I became so grateful for that experience, because it took me where I needed to go at that moment. And so it was actually for me, not just something randomly happening. It was purposeful. And without that, I'm not sure I would have been directed into hospice work. Maybe I would have. But it's almost like everything has purpose. Not at the time it's happening, because believe me, it was very painful for a long time. It's in the looking back that I can see how it's like pieces of the puzzle kept being put back together. It was for me. It was a gift for me, even though sometimes I wanted to say, please, no more presents. Please.
First of all, what is the Bible verse that says grief in the evening, joy in the morning?
I don't know.
Psalm chapter 30, verse 5.
Okay.
Is that how it goes?
Sorrow will come in the evening, but joy comes in the morning.
Sorrow will come in the evening, but joy will come in the morning.
Yeah.
I'm sharing what I'm about to say, what you said. Remember, I want to make it clear I'm sharing this with our audience. The Book of Mormon teaches that there must be an opposition in all things. We have to experience the bitter in order to appreciate the sweet. We have to experience the bad in order to appreciate the good.
Great. Always loved the word bittersweet, because that word itself kind of says that, doesn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you. That's beautiful. Thank you.
If I ask, does the word grace have a particular meaning for you?
Well, obviously, yes, it does. Meaning that it's almost as though we don't even need to be forgiven, because there's nothing to forgive, if you will. That's the way I kind of see grace. That in that space, there was simple acceptance of everything. And that you don't have to do anything to get that. It's a gift, freely given. Definitely.
I appreciate the talk. I was wondering, you mentioned that when you died, it was like you were experiencing a presence of the God of your understanding. Was that meaning that you were experiencing God as you understood God, or was that meaning that he started where you were understanding and expanded from that point? Or
maybe it was both things. Sounds like it might have been a little bit of both, but what I was really talking about was that understanding was so minimal at that point, based on pretty narrow religious training. But that after, and the ensuing 20, 30, 40 years, it became, my understanding grew. And so I like the way you said that, because I think it is that both things happened.
When you were in the middle in going through your experience, what was your awareness of your unborn baby?
You know, it's interesting. I often thought the only person that experienced that with me was that unborn child. And I actually, at that point, I really, when I was in that space or out of that pain, I really was not thinking a lot about that. It was really much more of a, if you will, a myopic kind of thing. I was doing that bargaining, please, just a finger, just something. It was the simplest sentence or words, but it was so profound. It was instantly I understood what those words meant. Then coming back, of course, I was back in the body and the whole experience. I think that she is a rather spiritual person. I'm not sure she understood the degree that I have, but she was the only one that was physically there with me. Did I leave that body with the baby in it? I don't know. I just knew I wasn't there anymore, and I wasn't in any pain. I couldn't look down and see my body. I didn't do that.
What would you recommend that people say to those that are dying in order to comfort them, especially those people who are not 100% sure but want to help that person? What should they say?
Well, it kind of depends, because just like every near-death experience, every death is kind of different. But I think the best thing you can simply do is to be with them, to be that presence with them, and to listen. Because we often think we have to say things, but more than anything, many times I would just sit in the silence with someone. And to be open, if they ask questions, to answer them honestly. For example, when I worked at the hospital trauma center, parents would say, okay, you could go in and talk to them, but don't use the D word when you're talking with them. And so I'd go in with the child, and you could guess the first thing the child would say to me, am I dying? And so I had to honor the parents and had to honor the children. And I came up with this. What I said was, what do you think? And the child would say, I'm dying. And no one will listen to me. Maybe we could talk, if you have a specific thing, we could talk later as to how it might be helpful. Listening is really important.
Hi, my name is Beth, and I am curious to know, as probably all the rest of the entire audience, when you got kicked out of your house or lost it, and you lost everything, there, all of a sudden, you left us in this big hanging mystery. Right. Did you guys, you and three kids, just live in your car? Seriously? Or did you find a cheap motel?
Yeah. Well, actually, I had 2 weeks before I had to leave. I walked into hospice that very day, and I was hired on the spot, which never happens. And I was able to borrow enough to get an apartment from my mother, and my first paycheck, of course, we were able to eat, we were able to drive a car and so forth. Having that family, my mother was not very close to me, but there were times that she came through, and that was one.
I'd like to get back to your question with the children when you left the response up to them. And they would ask you, am I dying? What was your response to that?
And
how
I said,
did you handle that?
I said, you're right.
Would they take it further, or
they
were
would
they
ask those questions? Does it hurt to die? That was the big thing. Dying was so painful for most of them. And I could reassure them. And I think for them, and I know this happens, children become the parents. When they are terminal, they go into a parent mode to protect their parents from this terrible thing that's happening. And so instead of being able to talk about it freely, they have to stuff it inside of them, never talking about it. And so when I walked in and said, what do you think? And they said, yes, I'm dying. Then I could say, you're right, and we can talk about it. And that was opening a segue for them, a tremendous burden, that somebody could sit and talk to them about dying. And it was okay. We could cry together. We could do whatever. Their parents, they could not do that with them.
I have an experience going to the other side, like everybody says, when I was a child. I don't remember exactly because I was a child. I question all my life about what is dying, what I'm doing here, what is everything, who is God, what is God, because it's a lot of gods created yes. by humans, you know? You know, it all depends where you live and your beliefs. We are living in this part of the earth, so we have these concepts about spirituality related to what they believe. If you go to another size, it's the same thing. Talking to a Japanese person who was a Buddhist believer, their concept of God is completely different.
Yes.
I mean, they don't even call God. Talking about the experience about dying is different. So this is my thing, what I want to go. What is dying? Who are we? What really what we see? Because if I put a different groups of culture, they will explain me completely different.
Exactly.
One, they see Maria, the other ones they talk about Jesus, the other one talk, I don't believe in that kind of gods that they believe. But I feel spiritual.
Yes.
I'm 61 years old, and through my years, I have a lot of experience. Normally, people, they see me, oh, you are gifted. I say, no, I'm not. Because who gave me that gift? What that comes from? What it is? So all my life, that is my journey here, to figure out everything.
Right.
The more than I figure out universe, the more that I figure out this planet where I live, the more that I figure out humans, why they move their eyes like this, why they, everything, I understand and I find beauty. I find I belong to the one.
Yes.
And I don't need any other kind of beliefs. And I'm so happy. All of us
have a gift.
It's not a gift. So we let other things create our reality, and that's not like that. All of us, we should thinking, what is dying? But very free, in a very free way to think. It's easy to think through previous inputs that they put us. I have a daughter that I have, and I saw her before she born, and she didn't live. She's not in this planet. And I perceive her, but I perceive her because I put in my brains an image for her. Probably
yes.
She doesn't even have that image.
Right.
The near-death experience is individual, but there are common threads. And as she has said, her experience is her experience. As Marlena has shared with her, hers is unique to her. So if you have heard a number of experiences, you'll know that each one comes from a totally different perspective. The one common thread is that they're transforming and there's a ripple effect that kind of goes on and on from that point forward.
So you said you gave birth to your second right around the age of 23.
Yes.
Right, so you and I were actually pretty close. I'm 22. I'm 5 months pregnant. So I'm curious. I'm really, really curious. You said that just after you had your experience that your second husband had, that you had actually ended up having your child. What kind of relationship did you end up having with that particular child? Like, I know my mom and I, like, we're two peas in a pod. We're super close. We're super alike. So we clash and fight a lot. But then again, we didn't go, well, as far as I know, we didn't go through an experience like that.
Yes. Well, she's my first daughter. I have five daughters, so she's my first. So I think the fact that she's my first daughter, there is that makes it very special. Yeah. Yeah, it's always kind of a special relationship there. Good luck to you, by the way.